This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanna studio today is Dr. Eric Emerson, who is director of the South Carolina Department of Archives and History. And we're going to talk about a variety of topics, but especially how does one preserve old papers, letters from the 18th century, state documents from the 19th century, which, by the way, are more fragile than the 18th century ones, and into the 21st century where everything is digitized. So, Eric, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you so much, Walter. It's great being here.
And let's talk a little bit about yourself, because everybody knows you're the director of the Department of Archives and History, but you edited the South Carolina Historical Magazine for a while. That's where we first met.
That's correct.
And then you became director of the South Carolina Historical Society.
That's correct.
And then you went to the Charleston Library Society.
Right.
And then you came to the State Archives.
That's...
So there's not much in the way of historic institutions and documents that you haven't been involved with through most of your professional career.
Well, I've been involved with a number of wonderful organizations, and I feel blessed to have had that chance.
Well, the reason we're having this conversation is because I grew up working in the State Archives as a graduate student, and they used to encapsulate the documents. I can't remember the term that they used, but it was not plastic, but
right. It
fused the document with something hard so that, for example, not just this graduate student, but any genealogist could go back to the original 18th century wills and inventories and actually handle them because this encapsulation made that possible.
That's correct. The method that most of the documents have been conserved using was called the Barrow method, and it was created by a man named William Barrow in Richmond, Virginia. And it takes two pieces of cellulose acetate, and you place the document between those two sheets, and you use heat to seal the document within those sheets of cellulose acetate. And Mr. Barrow thought that this method of conservation, of document preservation, would allow the document to last for hundreds of years. What he didn't take into account was the fact that within each of those documents, there's a certain amount of acid from the materials within it. And what happens is that cellulose acetate reacts with those acids, and then the documents start to break down and create something that called a vinegar syndrome, where you can actually – the document will smell like vinegar.
Okay. I thought that they used to give them a bath in something at the State Archives before they put that acetate on them.
Well, they did give them a bath, but it still doesn't account for the – even with the bath, there's a certain amount of materials within each of those – within that pulp paper. Most of the documents are made of pulp paper that causes them to break down once they're encapsulated. And so even with really fine paper like the Constitution of 1776, which is Wattman woven paper – that cellulose acetate reacts with that paper, and if you take a look at the 1776 Constitution, it's got dark and brown, and the document itself is starting to degrade, and so that process needs to be reversed or undone, and that's happened with thousands of documents because the agency was doing this through the early 1980s. We had our own machine. We thought Mr. Barrow, we didn't want to pay him to do all the documents, so we acquired a machine, started doing it ourselves in our conservation lab. And we really didn't learn as a field that this was a bad thing until the late 1970s.
I'm really curious, Eric, because I spent a lot of time in the old building over on Senate Street, old archives building. And every document that I used in writing my dissertation and then doing work after that, whether it was the wills, the inventories, the animal brand book, all of those had been encapsulated. And the word was they're now indestructible. And also, because in those days you could wander through the building and talk to folks.
Sure.
And the men who ran the machines who encapsulated these down in the basement said, can't ever undo this process. This is permanent. So now you tell me we've got the 1776 Constitution, which is the oldest of our actually enacted constitutions, and it's disintegrating. What are we going to do?
So there's a way of undoing the Barrow method, and this is the same thing we had to do with the first record book, which dates to 1671, and that's really the first time that we've had this undone. You have to bathe the document in an acetone bath, and then the conservators have to peel that cellulose acetate leaves off. You basically have to separate those leaves from the document itself, and then it has to be bathed to deacidify it further, and then let it dry, and then you do whatever cleaning you can to it. And then what we did with the first record book is we re-encapsulated it using Asian rice paper, which is inert. It doesn't have any chemical reaction to the document itself, and it's easy to undo. You would soak the document again in water, and that Asian rice paper would come off. So that's a less intrusive way of conserving documents now. And that's what the conservators did with the first record book. And that's what we hope that they'll do with the constitutions when we send those off.
Well, the encapsulation process, they used to be what they called the lab at the State Archives and did it themselves. Do you have a lab now to undo this process, or do you have to send it off?
Well, we do have a lab, and we have some kind of self-taught conservators. But one of the things that was lost during the budget cuts the past 20 years was the conservation staff. And this happened in a number of state archives around the country, that the conservation staff was one of the first things to go. And so now there are conservation companies, and there aren't very many of them that you send your documents off to have this undone. Now, I think the Library of Virginia has someone who does nothing but undo the Barrow method on the tens of thousands of documents that they have.
You said there were places who do this documentation. One of them's in Chapel Hill, right?
Right. There's one in North Carolina. So there are a number of conservation companies that deal specifically with documents. That's where most of the state archives and many of the private manuscript archives are sending their documents to have them conserved at these labs that are located around the country. But there aren't very many of them because there's not a lot of business.
And I think the Virginia State Library, they encapsulated a lot of their documents. Huge number. In fact, that's what, of course, Mr. Barrow from Virginia, that's where it started.
Right.
They've got some, but they do have a conservation person.
That's true, and that's all she does, and she's done it with thousands of documents, and that will keep her going for many years, I think, trying to undo this process that Mr. Barrow began.
Okay. Well, now let me ask you now. You've done the oldest record document we have, the record book.
That's correct.
All right, and it's got the rice paper on it, but whereas when it was encapsulated, basically anybody could look at that document. Now, with this rice paper cover, that's a little bit more fragile. Are people still going to be able to use it, or is this microfilmed or digitized now that's what you're going to use?
In its conserved state, it's really kind of a conserved artifact. And so it's been digitized. And so we have digital images for people to see. If they wanted to see the original record book itself as part of a tour of our stacks, we let people see it then. But if they need the information off it, it's been transcribed. And then if they actually want to see a good quality copy of it, we've got digital scans of it they can look at.
So if it's been transcribed, you could actually word search it, couldn't you?
That's correct.
Oh, man. That, in many ways, research is so much easier now, even with the old documents, because if something is transcribed and then it's word searchable, you don't have to read the whole document looking for Eric Emerson, an inventory or a will. It would just pop up.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Now, the constitutions are very special documents in South Carolina. Before the one in 1776, which we were the second colony or state to create a constitution, this is before the Declaration of Independence.
Right. 3 months prior to the Declaration of Independence.
So we were ahead of the game on the road to revolution. But people ask me all the time about, what about those fundamental constitutions? Now, there were three versions of the fundamental constitutions. We might want to talk about those for just a minute.
Sure. Now, we have one version that was part of our proprietary era document exhibit that we had a couple of years back. So we had that framed and on display as well. North Carolina, I know, has versions, but none of those were actually accepted or I guess today we would call them ratified, but none of those were actually approved for use itself.
Although political factions over the years referred to those as if they were holy writ, depending upon the cause that they were trying to.
Absolutely.
That's one of the fascinating things about that history. And I think that copy came with the Shaftesbury Project or Shrewsbury Project.
That's correct.
19th century, they went over and copied documents in the English records to bring back to South Carolina.
Right.
But those aside, and they're fascinating in itself, but the documents that you – original documents you actually have in your possession are every constitution we've had since 1776.
That's correct.
So you go to 1776, 1778.
Right.
1790.
1861,
1865, right. 1868, 1895.
That's right. It stops there.
I think I got them all.
You got them all. All seven. Excellent.
And that 1895 document, which was voluminous, mm-hmm. is it just printed or is it – because these other documents, the 1776 one was done on fine paper. I mean, it's
Absolutely.
A beautiful document. By 1895, wasn't it just a publication?
Well, by 1895, they're actually using ruled pulp paper, not too dissimilar to what we would have written on in school. So it's fascinating because the constitutions tell a history of not only the way that South Carolinians viewed government and how they should be governed and who they should be governed by, but it also tells a story of South Carolina's relative wealth. So you have 76 and 78, wonderful woven paper from England. 1790, it's on vellum, which is even more expensive. 1861, that constitution's on vellum, multi-pages, so that's even more expensive. And then you hit 1865, and that constitution's on pulp paper. It's ruled just like notebook paper.
So just like a blue book.
Very much
so. In college. And so you mentioned the difference in paper, and I think I dropped it a hint earlier. That older vellum in its natural state and that older paper is easier to conserve, whereas pulp paper, can you do anything really to conserve it?
You can. You can deacidify it, and then you can encapsulate it. And, you know, that's the most you can do with it. But it will deteriorate much quicker because it's the nature of the material itself.
Well, it's just like the older newspapers, which were done on rag paper. The originals, most of them in either the Historical Society, there's some in the Caroliniana, or in the Library Society, they're fine. It's the ones after that that are so fragile, they no longer let anybody use them.
Right.
All right. The changeover in paper really happened right after the Civil War. Part of it was economics. Part of it was, I think, invention. It was cheaper.
Absolutely.
And so as print media became more and more common, it was much cheaper to produce it on pulp paper.
Right.
And you don't know how many times somebody's said, I've got all of daddy's and granddaddy's books. I'd like you to look at them. And a lot of those from the 1880s are on pulp paper. And they say, well, they're crumbling. What are we going to do? And I'm saying, I'm sorry. The cost to have you preserve this book is just not going to be worth doing.
Absolutely. I mean, you and I both have, I'm sure, handled volumes where it just breaks your heart to actually try to open it up, or when someone brings something by to say, you know, what can we do with this? And you open it up and it just starts falling apart. It's just
I mean, sometimes you literally, even though you carefully turn a page, it'll crumble.
Right.
So as an archivist, you have to deal with those state records from the post-Civil War period, which are more fragile than the colonial records.
Well, that's true.
You know, I know the colonial records and many of the pre-Civil War records were encapsulated. Were the post-Civil War records encapsulated?
When you talk about foundational documents like the constitutions, they are encapsulated. Interestingly enough, the 1868 Constitution is encapsulated in Mylar. So it's actually in plastic that's been sealed around the edges. Each of those pages has been encapsulated that way. That paper of the three post-war constitutions, 65, 68, and 95, that's the worst quality paper. It's bleached white, ruled basically 8.5 by 14 notebook paper. And that's been conserved without using the barrow method, but instead encapsulated in Mylar. And that will all have to come out of that Mylar and then have to be conserved. It also has a number of rust marks where they took metal pins holding together in a volume, and it's rusted against the paper. And in the conservation process with that type of paper, when they bathe them, we're not sure how much of the ruling, how much of the color on the page will last. Now, the ink will still be there. But the conservators that we've spoken to think that we'll lose all the lines that, you know, be like a piece of notebook paper just becomes white.
But actually, having used the Mylar instead of the barrow method, mm-hmm. if you used the barrow method on those, they probably you couldn't. I don't think you could have separated it.
Well, it would have been very difficult. The So the 1895 Constitution, which is the biggest in sheer number of pages, it's 182 pages. That's been laminated using the Barrow method, and every one of those pages is going to have to be delaminated. So that's going to be the most expensive of all the constitutions. Conservators who've looked at it think that when you bathe it in that acetone bath, the color that's on the lines basically on the paper will come off, will bleed. And so you'll have to bathe it until those lines never show up. I mean, don't show up anymore. Otherwise, you'd have blue and red all over the page. And so the ink itself won't bleed. The ink is permeable, but the rest of it will come off.
Okay. If it's not tacky, how much is it going to cost to properly restore the 1895 Constitution, the Constitution as amended under which we now live?
Well, the one estimate we have is for roughly $50,000 for that one document.
Okay. People wonder, well, we can put it on a microfilm or you can digitize it, and that's all you need to do. I don't think I'm just being old-fashioned, but I know this from having had my students for 40 years go and use primary documents. When they actually handled a document, and they might not handle a Constitution, but let's just say a letter book or a will book or piece of Henry Lawrence correspondence, there was some kind of reaction, I'm actually holding a piece of history. Now, in terms of checking things out, I am so glad that the U.S. Census is now available, digitized, and if I want to find out how many people owned slaves in Lawrence County in 1860, I can search it
right.
for that. Prior to writing the history of South Carolina, researching 1996-97, I was going in and counting from the census by hand.
Right.
So, I mean, it makes a big difference. But those documents, and you still have folks who want to see the original documents and use them out at the archives, right?
We absolutely do. And when we bring groups of school children in, when this generation is so involved in seeing things digitally and seeing digital representations of things, to put gloves on a young person and let them touch something that's 200 years old. I mean, that's their eyes completely light up because it's real, it's tangible, it's tactile. It's something completely different from what they're used to, the way that they learn, the way that they see the world in a digital format. This is completely different. And it's something that I think will inspire future historians, future anthropologists, future archaeologists.
You mentioned that some of the documents have been transcribed, which is the old record book.
Right.
Tell us what's in the record book.
Well, the record book's really fascinating because the first record is a record of a deed for a town lot at Albemarle Point. So the secretary of the colony had lost most of his paper in a shipwreck as they were coming over, and so he was cobbling paper together when he created this first record book. So there's that deed. There's receipts for sugar from Barbados. It really tells the early story of the colony and its relationship with Barbados. I mean, you've got the wills of two early South Carolina governors. You've got shipping manifests from ships coming from Barbados. So a lot of really fascinating information in that record book.
And the next oldest document, I believe, is the Cattle Brands book. Has that one been conserved, modern, or is it still encapsulated?
That's still encapsulated.
Okay. I'm so glad that when school children come through the archives that you go through this process of letting them actually touch with white gloves on the original documents. But one of the things that bothers me in terms of history, if the documents aren't transcribed, so many kids today, and I don't care where they went to school, they can't read script.
Absolutely.
Actually, most 18th century script, particularly our public records, very easy to read. Private correspondence is another matter. But we don't yet have the technical know-how, I don't think, let's just take that original document, the Constitution. Without being transcribed, can that be word searched? Is there technology now that can look at an 18th century script? And
Not that I know of.
You've got to transcribe it. And I know we went through a process at Trinity Cathedral in Columbia. We had all of our records properly done up in at a place in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, oh, we got to have them word searched. And they said, well, you got to transcribe them. All we got a private grant for was to properly conserve them. and digitized. Now, they're digitized copies that are now in a bank vault.
Right, right. And that's, a great deal of the resources that we have today go towards digitizing records. And then we're receiving a lot of records in digital format as it is. And so the South Carolina Electronic Records Archive, which we began last year, majority of our records that we're ingesting now are coming in digital format.
Okay, so for example, even though the General Assembly continues to publish hard copies of their sessions, you're also getting digital copies of those, or?
Well, with that, we're getting hard copies. We haven't gotten digital. We haven't received digital copies of the General Assembly's records yet. But from, let's say, for the governor, from Ambassador Haley, her records are coming to us in digital format. Department heads or the heads of agencies' records come to us in digital format, and then various records that we're scheduling through our records management program are coming to us in digital format. And with very little manipulation, we can place those directly in the South Carolina Electronic Records Archive, and people can access them there. So the 1916 from DHEC, records from DHEC that are coming to us from 1916, we'll have to manipulate those a little bit, and then those will go straight into the South Carolina Electronic Records Archive as well.
In the old days, you get a records collection from an agency, and it includes almost every piece of paper, and so it has to be weeded out, organized, cataloged, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you're just taking it now as it comes?
Well, so if we've received email correspondence, you'd ideally have someone come in and you'd have them cull things that are not going to be of long-term or enduring value, that's just kind of group mail messages, things that we're all on, when you get on a listserv and you're just getting bombarded from a listserv. That's the kind of things we would want to call out. Ideally, before they send it to you, they would be calling those things out.
Because basically what you would keep a document if you're the agency of origin, and let's just say DHEC sends copies to five different of the state agencies who may have that document in their collection. Well, the carbons are whatever, you don't really need those.
Right, absolutely.
Okay,
right.
Because otherwise, you got a lot of space out there on your new archives building, but if you got all the paper created by state agencies today, you would be drowning.
Absolutely. The surprising thing for a lot of people is the number of paper records that we're receiving is diminishing rapidly. And so we don't think we'll ever need another building or more space, because we've installed compact shelving on our first floor in the first stack, and we have plenty of shelf space there. And with the diminishing number of paper records that state government's producing and local governments as well, we don't think we'll ever need any more space. Now, what we will need is lots and lots of server space, lots of ways to store these things so that we can place them in an electronic record archive and people can have access to them remotely whenever they want. And that's ideal for us, that researchers can go in and find the records they need without having to travel to our building.
Okay. All right, Eric, we need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Eric Emerson, Director of the South Carolina Department of Archives and History, about preserving old records and having access to them. To be devil's advocate, things are being digitized now. Are they being kept on CDs, or how are you conserving them?
Well, so we could get a great deal of records just on a little flash drive from an agency. They could send a flash drive, they could send to us on a CD, they could send to us and use a number of mediums to us, and then we ingest those into our system, into our servers. And so we have servers at the Department of Archives and History that operate the Electronic Records Archive and the Historic Property Records. And then we have a backup system that's located at Winthrop in Rock Hill. So if anything tragic were to happen to the archives, that material is constantly being backed up, and that would be available at our remote servers. And so,
well, I'm just thinking of the way records were copied over the years, particularly oral records. People can't access them because the equipment doesn't exist, and technology is moving so fast. Are you constantly changing it? I'm just worried about sometime in the future. Yeah, you may have a flash drive, you're not able to read the thing.
Well, no, absolutely. So the material that we're ingesting into our system, we use something, a software called Preservica. And it was established by a company that was and initially designed it for the British Public Records Office, for the British Archives in the UK and in European archives, and it spread to the United States. It was the only out-of-the-box solution we could find. And what it does is it basically is constantly upgrading that material so that it never, you know, gets into a format that you can't, you know, you can't access. In other words, it's a way for you to make sure that something's always up to date without having to worry about, you know, well, we've got to upgrade this to this software. We've, you know, constantly. And that was part of the benefit of using that out-of-the-box solution. Now, we do have forms of records, you know, recordings and things like that, that we no longer have the capacity to get access to them. But fortunately for us, there are places in the country that can basically convert that to a digital format, and then we can ingest that in electronic records archive. The group at USC, they're basically converting for us all of the video that we had within the archives, and what they'll keep a copy for us, and they'll give us a copy, and then we'll ingest that in the electronic records archive as well. So, and that's one of the things we're focusing on right now, trying to take all these kind of forms of media that we can no longer do something with and convert them to a digital format that we can ingest in the electronic records archive.
Yeah. Again, working with individuals, families who have collections, one of the least staple things to save are old colored photographs.
Right.
Old black and whites are a whole lot better.
Sure.
You know, I was with some friends back in hometown of Mobile, and they had some records, photographs rather, from the 1970s. And they had, even though they were out of light, the color had just faded so bad that they were almost indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad. And gosh, anything on a disc, the shelf life of that is not very long anymore.
No, it's not. And so the quicker people can get those images to someone who can scan them for them or conserve them. And there are even now a number of companies who will can take something that looks relatively faded out, and using modern technology can kind of restore it to how it would have looked at the time. And I've seen companies who can take ripped photographs and can, you know.
Yeah, but it's an expensive process.
It is an expensive process.
And this family actually took a group from a reunion and sent them, I think it was almost $50 a photograph.
Absolutely. fascinating things, but it's not inexpensive, as you said. It's an expensive proposition.
I find it interesting that the state is getting, in terms of record keeping, increasingly paperless. So are we going to reach a point where, you know, when a bill's passed, it is a paper document, it is signed, and you will get that original eventually, right?
Right, that's correct. So you'll have presentation copies of things that are very nice and look like historic documents have always looked. But the majority of things that we get will be in a digital format, which is, it raises some interesting questions for us as historians and archivists. So we show children and adults these great kind of foundational documents. And when they look at them, you know, it intrigues them, kind of stands out, it captures their imagination. But in the future, you wonder what kinds of documents will we be showing people that, I mean, will you show them an email and say, look, this is really important? And it, you know, it doesn't have, or a text message, oh, this, look at this, you know, it doesn't convey the same.
Oh come on. You mean an email with an emoticon?
It raises some interesting questions. And that's, I mean, it'll be important in its own way, but it won't really kind of stand out. It won't be an artifact, you know, like these documents are that we're discussing now. And then the other thing is people don't view electronic records the same way they do paper records, because a paper record's substantive. And if you want to keep a paper record, you have to set it aside and you have to create space for it. And if you want to get rid of it, you actually have to go through the process of shredding it or tearing it up or burning it or something like that. But if you want to get rid of a digital record, you just press a button and it's gone. And you can instantaneously get rid of thousands of digital records if you wanted to get rid of them. And so it's that the ease of storing something. You don't see it taking up physical space, even though it's on your server, and then being able to destroy it so quickly, so readily, it makes it more likely that we will lose, and of course we are losing, really important digital records, because people don't view them the same way they view paper records.
I just wonder, for future historians, people say, oh, there'll be lots of records. I'm not going to be convinced there can be lots of records. I think that a lot of things are happening where it's verbal. People don't have to record their telephone calls.
Right.
They may have a telephone log depending upon the office, but what took place over that telephone call?
Right.
Or a meeting. This one's being recorded between us, but we've also had lunch together and talked about preserving documents and that kind of thing. No record of that.
Sure. Absolutely.
But once upon a time, as the State Archive, you would have been keeping a diary, perhaps.
Right.
Like Mr. Sally or some of your predecessors.
There would have been memos and there would have been, you know, pieces of notepaper that people would have saved. And you're right. I mean, I think that a lot of people, for legal reasons, will fear, you know, saving. And we know that they do, you know, fear saving electronic correspondence.
Earlier, you mentioned that at the archives, people can now access documents without having to physically come into the State Archives to research. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, for a while, we've had an online record index where we were digitizing records and placing them online for people to access. That was not serving all the purposes we need, as we talked about, the way to make sure that something's constantly up to date, that you don't have to, you know, you're not going out there trying to find the next update in something. And we needed a way to basically capture digital records, have those records copied, and then copies sent off to people as they requested them. And so that's why we created the South Carolina Electronic Records Archive. And so we still have the Online Records Index where you can look at digital copies of images. We have the South Carolina Electronic Records Archive where you can do the same thing. And then we also have developed the South Carolina Historic Property Record, which entails and basically is a digital archive of all of our National Register properties. Anything dealing with the State Historic Preservation Office is going in the South Carolina Historic Property Record. So, you know, if you're a developer or you're an archaeologist or you want someone who's interested in a property, you can go to that and get information about those various properties. So our goal is to make, and this is kind of, in a way, we're putting our research room out of business, where the goal is to make as many of the people's records available to them in the easiest manner possible to be available remotely.
Okay. I go to the digital archives. If I want to print something down, have I got to pay for it or is it free?
Well, if you download it off of your computer, you can print it up at your home and that's fine.
Okay.
It just doesn't, if you're in our building and you want to use one of our printers, then you have to pay for that copy because we're actually operating the printer and we're paying for the paper. But if you can access it from your own home, if you wanted a hard copy, you just print it up on your own computer. There's no charge.
I know a lot of private organizations, particularly with the issue of photographs, they will have things posted, but if you want, you can't really take it down. You've got to pay for it because that's how they stay in business.
Sure. Our view on that is it's these records, in whatever medium they are, in whatever form they belong, are the records of the people of South Carolina.
Okay.
And we keep the people. That's our job, is to keep the people's records and make those records available to the people.
Okay.
And so we do it, you know, the only time we charge the people for something is when we have to maintain a printer and pay for paper or something like that, or if we have to do research for someone. If someone just gave us a name and said, can you find out something on that, and we have to take a staff member away and they have to spend a considerable amount of time finding out about that person, then we would charge for that. But other than that, you know, they belong to the people, and so they should have free access to them.
Yeah. Small museums and historical societies around the country, and I've used different ones, it's amazing over the years the increase in the fee because they need that income.
Right. Absolutely. And it makes sense with private organizations who are dealing with private papers.
Yeah. Of course, not having folks come in, particularly the private organizations, that they worry about digitizing material because if they don't have visitors, then why did they exist?
Right.
It used to be that the State Archives, and I'm going back to the 1960s here, was open 7 days a week, 9 to 9 on weekdays, and from 1 to 9 on Sundays.
Right.
But you don't have nearly the foot traffic now. I mean, it used to be that research room back on Senate Street literally was jammed for the entire time it was open.
Right. Right. And I've talked to a number of staff members who can remember working night shifts and weekend shifts, things that I wouldn't, you know, I've had staff members joke that the only days they were off would be Christmas Day and Easter. And they would there would be somebody there every other day or close to every other day. But we don't have the kind of foot traffic. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing the amount of people come in diminishes every year. And a lot of that has to do with, as you were talking about, using census records and things like that. So you've got private companies like Family Tree and Ancestry and things like that that are putting documents, making documents available to people on a subscription basis. And then we're putting documents online as quickly as possible to make them available to people. So there's less reason for them to come in. Now, there are a lot of things that aren't digitized that they have to come see. You know, the probate records and things like that are not digitized. And so if they're doing an in-depth genealogical search, they have to come to us. And to be honest with you, the staff really enjoys that. I mean, I think they want to be actively engaged in helping someone find their ancestors or help them find what they want to do when one comes in.
One of the great resources that I've begun using in the last couple of years are Historic American newspapers, and they're word searchable. They're available. It depends upon the county library. Richland County, for example, has the state newspaper from 1891 to the present. The Charleston County Library has got a national newspaper base, not just the News and Courier, the Post and Courier, the Mercury, what have you. So it's going to depend upon how proactive your local library is. The Charleston County Library is very active, great local research room. Nick Butler, of course, is doing a fine job down there. But Debbie Bloom in the Richland County Library here, I went in there. I didn't know about it. I said, I'd like to use the microfilm. And she said, why? And I said, I've got a comment. And she said, no, you're a library member. You can access this from home. Now, the same thing with Charleston County. If you've got to be a member of the Charleston, you've got to be a card-carrying member to be able to access it from your house.
Sure.
But hey,
that's a great benefit.
Eric, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about the seven constitutions, and so let's kind of run through them briefly as to what they were all about. 1776 was a wartime document,
right? That's correct, and it's created by a provincial Congress who had been in place since the royal governor had dissolved the General Assembly in 75, so you've got a provincial Congress that forms, and then they realize you need some sort of basis for government, and so they create that document that they approve on March 26, 1776. And it establishes a General Assembly or reestablishes a General Assembly. It creates the positions of president and vice president of the state. President would be John Rutledge and vice president Henry Lawrence, who would later be president of the Continental Congress and captured and imprisoned at the Tower of London. A chief justice, William Henry Drayton. All of these people would be elected by the General Assembly. They controlled all those positions.
And that's a very important thing as we can carry through, is that the General Assembly is in charge from the very beginning. People discover the legislative state about every other year in the local media. It's been around. It actually predates this, too, because the Commons House of Assembly was electing most of the local offices, justices of the peace and whatever before this. Okay. Let's move on to the next one.
Okay. So that constitution is set up, and the wording was really kind of interesting. It says, quote, until an accommodation of the unhappy differences between Great Britain and America can be obtained. So it's a temporary document. They think we're going to get back together with Great Britain. Well, of course, after the Battle of Fort Sullivan and what we know is Carolina Day on June 28, 1776, they realize that's not going to happen.
Yeah, because actually Rutledge was in favor of something like a commonwealth, what we today call the British Commonwealth of Nations.
Right.
He wasn't a very hot for independence to begin with.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. All right.
So by 1778, the General Assembly realizes they need something different, a different document. So they pass a new constitution on March 19th. It creates a South Carolina Senate, upper house, but that's popularly elected. And instead of a president and a vice president, they go to a governor and a lieutenant governor, of course, both of which are elected by the General Assembly once again. One of the interesting things is it disestablishes the Church of England as the official church of the colony. But it establishes, and the words they used was Christian Protestant religion would be deemed the state religion, which is kind of interesting as well.
Which, remember, under the fundamental constitutions that were not adopted but basically were honored, anyone who believed in God could settle here, and that's why South Carolina had the largest Jewish population of any of the colonies.
Right. That was a great way to draw as many different types of settlers in as you could, as many as possible.
Yeah. Okay, back to 1778.
Okay, so the next constitution was 1790. That's a constitution that's created after the United States Constitution is passed, and that's the first constitution created by a convention of the people. The other two have been created by the General Assembly, and it would last until 1861, so 71 years is the second longest-running constitution. Of course, once again, the governor is elected by the General Assembly, has no veto power, once again establishing legislative dominance there. The General Assembly continued to elect all holders of major offices, presidential electors, U.S. senators, local officials, and then it sets out some guidelines regarding how someone could serve in the House. It had to have a certain amount of property, a certain amount of money.
We're still having property qualifications for office holding, which again goes back to the colonial period.
Right.
And by the time we get around to 1860, we're the only state who still elects governor. The governor is elected by the General Assembly, by the legislature.
Right.
Okay. All right. We got a new constitution, 1861, kind of makes sense because we're now in a new country. And that constitution isn't too different from the 1791.
No, it's very similar. All it does is make reference to secession and the fact that it's no longer the state's no longer part of the United States of America. The General Assembly continues to elect the governor. One of the interesting things is it's drawn up by the secession convention and put together. They were producing a large number of records because the General Assembly is only meeting 1 month out of the year, basically November, December. And so there's no other power base except for the secession convention. They create this constitution. This one, I haven't said anything about it before, but this is a vellum document, multi-paged. It's 18 pages, and it's in the worst condition of all of them. It's got large sections of it have been consumed by what I assume to be rodents. It's got mold and mildew on it. It's one of those documents that was really misplaced or lost after, in 1865, William Hunt saves the state's most important records as federal troops are shelling Columbia.
Yeah, they're shipped on the railroad.
Right. They put them on a boxcar, attach them to an engine, and taking up to Chester and Charlotte, offloaded there and then transferred to Greenville where Governor McGraw's government is operating there. Well, when those documents come back to Columbia, they start getting moved around. Just think it's just like if when someone gives you something or leaves something, a family member leaves you something, stuff goes into the attic or you might misplace it.
Out of the basement.
Right.
Well, out of the garage or whatever.
Absolutely. So that constitution with a number of the state's records ends up in the basement of the state house under some leaky pipes in a cardboard box and was in really bad shape when it was when Mr. Sally discovered those in the 1940s. And there's very little that conservators can do with that. So it'll probably be the least expensive to conserve because you just can't do anything with it.
Okay.
So then with the Constitution of 1865, one of the really interesting things about that is the convention takes place at First Baptist Church in Columbia, the same place where the Secession Convention first met on December 17, 1860. So you've got this experiment in South Carolina independence starts at First Baptist, and it really concludes with that Constitution, which is ratified on September 27th.
And they're having to meet at First Baptist because the State House was burned on February 17th, 1865.
Absolutely. So the old State House has been burned. The new State House isn't complete, and that's the only place where they can really meet. And that's not exactly a revolutionary document, but it does some interesting things. It does away with all the election parishes that it carried over from the Church of England and Barbados and creates districts, which would be counties by 1868. And it provides for the first popular election of a governor in South Carolina, abolishes property qualifications for office holding. And then Governor Perry, who is a provisional governor of South Carolina and is overseeing this process, he's really pushing for equal political rights and civil rights for the freedmen, for African Americans, and the Constitutional Convention refuses to do it. So
they do recognize that slavery is abolished.
Right. They recognize that slavery is abolished, but don't grant any rights for voting or political rights.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the next one.
Okay. So the next one, I guess, is really the revolutionary constitution that South Carolina creates, and that's the Constitution of 1868. So it meets in the clubhouse of the Charleston Club, which was an exclusive planners organization in Charleston. And it's now – it would have been located on kind of the grounds where the federal courthouse is, right beside the post office. It would have been behind the – behind what was then the guardhouse. And it's three-fifths of the convention – are African Americans. About roughly half of those are former slaves. It's and so it's written to basically meet the dictates of congressional reconstruction, whereas the previous one had been written for readmittance of the state to the Union.
And the Ohio Constitution certainly had an impact on that.
That's right. So you've got a number of people from Ohio who are part of the convention, and they supposedly kind of draft it. With that in mind, it's really important things are it granted political and civil rights to African Americans for the first time. There's no property qualifications for voting. Every male in South Carolina can vote thereafter. And that's a really kind of revolutionary thing. Disenfranchisement only occurs based on being convicted of murder, robbery, or dueling, which is really interesting because dueling is that kind of Southern honor concept that held antebellum South that had, was so pervasive in antebellum South Carolina. And the other big thing that comes out of it is a universal education for South Carolina's children. And that's the longest standing thing because the political rights would be overturned with the 1895 Constitution, but the 1895 Constitution reinforces the idea that all of South Carolina's children deserve a public education.
Yes. We had no real public school system in South Carolina prior to this Constitution. Charleston City had one, but statewide, no.
Right, right. And another interesting thing, and this is really important, that's the only Constitution that's submitted to the people for ratification. So everyone gets to vote on that.
Yes. Now, that we've had seven constitutions. The earlier ones were just written by the legislature and adopted by the legislature. The 1791, there actually was a convention, but it was not submitted for ratification.
Right.
1861 was not submitted to the people for ratification.
Right.
1868 was.
Right.
And then we come to the current Constitution, which was rather controversial, not just because of what's in it, but because a lot of historians and even certain people in that day don't believe that the people actually voted to have a new constitutional convention.
Right.
That Ben Tillman rigged the result so that – because he wanted a constitutional convention.
Right. He had been asking for – he had been lobbying for a new constitution even before he was governor. Starting in 1885, he was saying this – we've got to replace that constitution. Becomes governor in 1890 and he's still pushing for it. By 1895, he puts things in motion to make this constitutional convention happen. It's really kind of interesting that the Redeemers, who end Reconstruction in 1877, seem pretty satisfied with the 1868 Constitution because they do nothing to undo it. It's not until they're actually out of office that it's Tillman and his people are the ones who actually.
Well, there was one other thing in the 1868 Constitution, and that is districts or counties actually had true local government.
Right.
Something that disappeared in 1895.
Sure, sure.
1895 Constitution began the really accelerated the disenfranchisement of African Americans.
Right.
The universal school system, which came in 1868, it was clearly to be segregated by race.
Right.
Jim Crow laws didn't come until actually after the 1895 Constitution, but the groundwork was laid. And then one of the things that is part of that Constitution is all sorts of boards and commissions and elected separately elected people come into existence because Tillman always had the fear that his enemies might get reelected, boot his friends out of office. But if you've got so many different elected offices and boards and commissions, which he filled with all his friends, then they'd still be able to run the government.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's why we have what has been called in the 20th century when we went through constitutional reform under Governor Carroll Campbell, the horse and buggy constitution. We still got the horse and buggy constitution.
Absolutely.
Even though it's been amended a number of times.
Right. I think by 1966 it had been amended 330 times by that year, and there was still much left to go at that junction.
Yeah. Okay. Eric, I hate to do it. Alfred's given me the wind-up sign, and he's really tough. He's going to cut us off if I don't shut up. Any last words for our listeners about what's going on at the archives, about the preservation of documents, and we've covered a wide range of topics here, all of which I'd like to talk for about another 3 hours, but we can't. So, Bud, you've got the last word here.
Well, Walter, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. If people have questions about conserving their documents, I mean, we have people on staff who can advise them in regards to that. So just give us a call or come on by, and we'll be glad to help you at least steer you in the right direction in regards to conservation. We just hired a new conservationist, which is we're real excited about after having lost our conservation staff over several years. So we hope to be doing more of this in the future. So we hope people come by the archives and let us assist them in any way possible.
Okay. Well, Dr. Eric Emerson, Director of the South Carolina Department of Archives and History, it's been a great pleasure having you back on the Journal.
Well, thank you so much, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Researching today is quite different from what it was in 1967 when I was working on my graduate degree. In many ways, it's easier, but in some ways, with modern technology and online researching, you miss touching the document. The State Department of Archives and History is preserving some of our state's historic records, particularly the 7 constitutions that have governed the state, so that they will be available in their original form for school children, citizens to see for hopefully centuries to come. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.